prop here. I'll show you later. It's great to be back. For those of you that don't know, last week I was at a colloquium in at Bar-Ilan University in Tel Aviv. And we were studying spiritual and religious leadership in academic life. The name of the colloquium was Faith in Multiple Truths, and subtitle Spiritual Leadership in the Academy. So I'm still a little jet-lagged. Please forgive me. I taught a class on Thursday, and I really felt sorry for everybody. We had a prospective student that came into the class, and I thought, oh, she's just going to blow us off. Anyway, so I wanted to talk about this because it was an opportunity to practice with difference. And I'll tell you a little bit about the people that were there. So this was an opportunity to encounter people in close, up close, and in a sustained way. People with whom I differ substantially and also share a certain life experience. The subject of the colloquium was difference, in a way. How do you live with difference? How do you practice with difference? But it was also our experience of difference as we met together. How do we actually listen to one another, which is one of the things I want to talk about today. So we were a small group. There was 15 of us at the colloquium, 20 counting the graduate students that were there, and we spent 5 days together. Seriously together, right? So the first day was Sunday because that's the first weekday in Israel, and we got together and we were together till like 8 o'clock at night, next day 8:30 in the morning till about 7 o'clock, next day 8:30 in the morning till about 11 o'clock at night, because we went to Jerusalem and had dinner. And it was the hospitality was truly amazing, wonderful, and so it was a little sesshin like, a little like you're together and you are together on the bus, in the conference room, at the meal, everything. So. In addition to our Israeli host, the participants were from Europe and the U.S. Bar-Ilan is an Orthodox Jewish university. The students there are not all observant Jews. There are also Muslims that go to school there and some Christians. Not a lot of Christians, but some. But the faculty and graduate students were all modern Orthodox, what they referred to themselves as modern Orthodox, were all observant. And the other participants were Protestants of various denominations, two Greek Orthodox, a Hindu monk, and me. And our group included people from a wide range of universities, from my own school, which is a pretty progressive consortium of seminaries in Berkeley, and schools like University of Chicago, Georgetown, kind of more mainstream, so to speak, Baylor, which is kind of in the middle. It's a Texas Christian university that's very open in many ways. The Greek Orthodox teachers from Marquette and from the GTU, a professor from Brigham Young University, and a professor from Oral Roberts University. Okay? I'll give you some idea of the theological and political differences. What I found was I had assumptions. You know? And I got to see those assumptions. I got to practice with those assumptions. Without exception, well, one fellow was a little bit challenging, let's say that, because he knew the truth. But everyone was consistently respectful, kind, and intelligent. None of us knew why we were there. Honestly, most of us had never heard of Bar-Ilan University before. And in fact, many of us thought, in fact, one of the people that was the graduate student that was in charge said, she had to reassure many of us many times that it was not a scam. Because it was, you know, get this invitation out of nowhere, please come to Israel for a week, all expenses paid. And we're like, none of us were famous, you know. It's not like it was a bunch of famous people that they went through the internet and found us. And we were saying, why did you pick us? So Rabbi Shabtai, who was the organizer of it, said, I wanted to get to know people who actually work with people, not just, you know, thinkers, people who actually work with people. But we still were like, what are we doing here? What are we doing here? And each of us had to give a presentation, so we had developed our presentations without ever knowing what we were supposed to be doing. Which meant made for a very rich experience. Only two people had had a relationship with anyone at Bar-Ilan before. So what, as it turned out, what was expected was that we share our experience of being people committed to a faith tradition within an academic setting and answering the questions together. How does that work? What are the rubs? The questions, the challenges, the opportunities. What do we think is important? What can we learn from each other? In other words, it was a petri dish. It was an experiment in practicing with difference in close quarters, listening to each other. Our host brought us together to see what we might come to know about faith and difference and shared commitment. So when the chaplain from Duke, the academic chaplain from Duke, gave a presentation about how the architectural or the layout of Duke, which is quite formulaic, so-called secular university, when they laid it out, they put the chapel in the middle. The big chapel. It's on all of their, you know. So what does that mean? When something bad happens, when there was a shooting or something, people came to the chapel. Doesn't matter whether they were religious or whatever. What is that? What draws people in? Over meals and on the bus, we went to Jerusalem, we went to Jaffa, we visited the home of Rabbi Shabtai, who lives in Old Jerusalem, go through this like narrow passageway, up these stairs, into this room. Two rooms, a living space and a kitchen space, and then through a door into this library that's something out of Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Four floors, the spiral staircase with books and antiquities and pictures of his family, and then out through this tiny, tiny door that one of our member could just barely squeeze through to a rooftop overlooking Jerusalem, mm-hmm. the Dome of the Rock, the bells. This particular faculty member has studied a long time in India and knew something of Buddhism. There was such a feeling of being immersed in wisdom in that space, and learning and questioning. So engaging in this way, this was human-to-human contact. It was a shared experience. It was a way of building bridges and revealing our shared humanness, right? So, you know, I had a wonderful, long, delightful conversation with the fellow from Oral Roberts and his quite accomplished wife. And I thought, who would have thought this? You know, who would have predicted this? We were not ignorant of the differences that we had, both in faith and probably in politics. But we chose not to make them central. So as a group, there were ways we skirted differences. We didn't talk about gay rights or the occupation. Was that wrong? Was that avoiding? Was it skillful means? At what point do you need to speak up about what's not spoken? And when do you find common ground so that when something is spoken, there's a chance it's heard? So these are important ethical questions that I felt were very alive in my time there. And there's no set answers. As a Buddhist in the room, I did speak about the fundamental differences between our traditions and the teachings of other people, and also about the ways that we share a certain experiences. So when one of the graduate students guided us around the grounds of Bar Ilan and this wonderful garden that was laid out in a certain way, and she said, "This garden represents wrapping oneself in the talit, which is the prayer shawl, sometimes called." When I heard that, I heard our robe chant. You know? Wearing or wrapping oneself in the Tathagata's teachings. You know, so what we shared was not the theology, what we shared was wrapping. We shared the experience of wrapping, and we could meet there. Another time, over the food was amazing. Over dinner, I was talking with one of the recent PhD students, graduates, who had just lost his teacher. This is not just an academic teacher. This is a spiritual teacher. This was the rabbi he studied with. And we talked about what it means to have a teacher, what it means to lose a teacher, what it means to keep going, and how a teacher continues to be your teacher even when they're gone. So this was a shared experience. We studied text together. We studied a portion from Genesis. And we studied the Vedas. So Prabhacharya, the young Hindu monk, was quite funny, brought a section of the Vedas, and everybody participated in talking about it. And then we talked about this portion that has to do from the biblical writings. It has to do with the Tower of Babel, right? And how people came together to create one language. And then, according to this, God was like, no, broke it up. So they gave us these little hats. This is my prop. See, we all wear these little hats. It says one language, right? And there's a story behind this. But so when it came time to take a picture, I took my hat off. It's like, you are not. And I must say, they out-Japanese the Japanese. We had more pictures taken everywhere we went. Hey, sign up for a picture. But I learned something, and we learned something together by looking at these sacred texts. And I was very, very hesitant. I was like, what have I got to say about this biblical teaching? But as I listened together with them, I had a perspective about what might be there. And so I said, if this were a Buddhist text, this is what I would say. And it shifted things, you know? And the same with the Vedas. You know, it helped us. So we were distinct. We were each distinct, and no one was being asked to give up their distinctness. But we were together in our effort. I was grateful for my young Hindu monk friend who understood my ways when others did not. And for others who were particularly open and thoughtful. The Baptist chaplain and professor from Baylor in particular. So I asked myself, what do I return to? What did I return to? What guided me in this? You know, I think all of us were a little anxious when we got. I know all of us were a little anxious. Like, what are we going to do? How are we going to be together? You know, the professor from Oral Roberts talked about the ways in which, and from BYU talked about the ways in which they had to be better than everybody else because it was assumed, because they were evangelical Christians or Mormons, that they were stupid. You know, evangelical Christians are stupid. Oral Roberts? How could they be doing anything academically worthwhile there? So when we bring these histories together, there's a level of anxiety. Difference can create anxiety. I thought, how are these people going to understand? And I decided to present on the teachings of emptiness, the Bodhisattva vow, and dependent co-arising. I thought, okay, you've got 10 minutes to present the core Buddhist teaching. But you know what? They listened, and they got it in a certain extent. And some didn't. But what was that, you know, what did I rely on in bringing myself forward in that way? What did I recall? What I came back to was how. How is the whole point. In each moment, in each activity, in each interaction, in our relationships, how, in this moment, do I express my Bodhisattva vow? How do I harmonize body and mind with the community? How do I realize and manifest Buddha's way? It sounds very lofty, but especially when we're confronted by difference, we can call ourselves back to that, right? There's not a fixed answer. It's the process. It's the process of placing and making the effort to place that in the center. When we do that, we're not erasing differences, but we're not hardening and turning them into ways to subvert the whole and win. Yeah. So I returned again and again to how do I listen? How do I see my assumptions kind of floating across my mind and not allow that those assumptions to hijack the encounter. You know, when I met this fellow from Oral Roberts, his hair was perfect evangelical hair. Do you know what I mean? It's a cultural statement. Well, you know, those things can get in the way. His wife was Mrs., right? And then we got into this conversation and she told me how she's like the president of this research institute into legal, you know, all these. I was like blown away. These were my assumptions. And it's so easy for us to just slot those in, isn't it? Say, oh, this person looks the certain way, or this person's from a certain place, or this person talks a certain way. And so I know who they are. And I'm going to let those assumptions get in the way. Which doesn't mean that there weren't real differences. For this fellow, and I'm thinking of one other person who said, what are the consequences of not accepting Buddhism? This was a very strong evangelical Christian. It was very clear. It was like, do you go to hell? So for me, again and again and again, what is harmonizing here with the situation without ignoring differences? How do I see my assumptions? How do I let them float by? This is an act of intention, right? It's an effort. You can't be lazy in a circumstance like this. It's an act of giving and it's an act of respect. So it was interesting that the portion that we studied was on how the effort to make one language didn't work. Because it's in the richness of the diverse languages that one language emerges. And it's not one language of everything's the same. It's one language of many, many, many voices coming together. So this harmony is not, you know, perfect harmony in a certain way. There's a discordant element to it. This effort to be present takes a certain amount of courage. It takes remembering who we are. I was reminded of Kito Sensei. I've spoke of this before. Kito Sensei talks about Fudo heart, this unshakable capacity to pursue and express compassion, to not be thrown, this undaunted stability, to not turn away in ambiguity, in unease, when things are unsettled, when our world doesn't match the people that we are with. How often does that happen in your families? You know, how often does that happen when somebody voted for somebody that you didn't vote for? How often does that happen when somebody has a completely different vision of what goodness or beauty or success is? So when we touch Fudo's heart, we don't need to claim sameness to ease an anxiety. We don't need to be right. We can allow the other to be other. And at the same time, share our humanity. The pallet is not the same as Buddha's robe, but wrapping is something that we can share. So there's a kind of paradox here. When we fully and completely commit ourselves to our tradition, and appreciate that others will do the same, this shared commitment is where we meet. It it is the primary point of dialogue and communication. There we can be in this complexity. Dogen Zenji said, life is, for example, like people sailing on a boat. Although we set sail, steer our course, and pull the boat along, the boat carries us and we do not exist apart from the boat. By sailing the boat, we make the boat what it is. In riding in the boat, one's body and mind and the self and world are together the dynamic functioning of the boat. The entire earth and the whole empty sky are in company with the boat's vigorous exertion. Such is the I that is life and the life that is I. So our little boat at Bai Lan was the boat of us in this together. We were in it together. And we were creating this thing together. And we touched each other. And we changed each other. Because we weren't, according to our teaching, we weren't isolated selves that come together and like bumped up against each other like molecules at war or something. We came together. We listened together. We touched one another. These words teach us how we exist, how to live in accord with the Buddha way. We exist in our own particularity, and we exist completely dependent upon one another. That group of people was just that unique group of people. If any of it had changed, it would have been completely different. So realizing this how reveals reality to us. It frees us from narrow-mindedness, rigidity, and the suffering that those bring. It changes us, and it changes our relationship to others. So this little boat, this life, included me, it included everyone, included all reality, included the history of Israel, it included the history of Europe, it included every dimension, everything was present there. All of the face. And together we brought this particularity. And who knows what will come of it? You know, there's an effort to continue this, probably will, but the point is, in that moment, something happened. When I was working to guide myself and bring myself wholeheartedly to the situation, another phrase or text that I thought of was something else by Dogen. Observe the activities of Buddha for a while. Buddha's activities take place with the entire earth and all sentient beings. If they are not with all existence, they are not yet the activities of a Buddha. Okay? Observe the activities of Buddha for a while. Buddha's activities take place with the entire earth and all sentient beings. If they are not with all existence, they are not yet the activities of a Buddha. So this is an aspiration that we have. In that moment, in that group of people, to bring myself fully there as myself, it meant challenging myself to be an active Buddha, to act with all existence in that moment. So this was listening. This was bringing myself forward. This was an aspiration, a guide, a way of committing to enact the Buddha way. Not just to talk about it. We weren't just talking about our faiths. We were bringing them into the room. Some I felt a deeper kinship with than others. But that rub, one of the fellows that I connected with most deeply, is this Baptist chaplain at Baylor, And he did a statistical analysis of student thriving and religious affiliation. And what he found was that people in minority faith traditions tended to thrive more than students from the majority faith tradition. So then he looked more deeply and he said, why? And the reason was the rub. That when you're in a situation that rubs, you have to dig deeper. And what he said as a Christian pastor was, we've been too easy on our Christian students. We need to make it a little harder for them. Instead of supporting, we need to make it a little harder for them. Because they will thrive more. They will grow more. So these situations of rub, these situations where we're invited to go across the world and sit in a room with 15 people for 5 days, or we go to a family reunion, or we go to work, or we go wherever, these situations of rub, when we take them as an opportunity to remember what guides us and to listen, we grow and we bring some measure of what may be greater peace, a little drop of something to the world. And maybe we have some fun too and make unexpected friends. So I encourage you to look for places of rub. At the same time, remembering what grounds you. Because without that, rubs can become too distressing. Okay, I think I'll end there.